This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. New allegations of child abuse against Catholic clerics in Germany are threatening to engulf the church there. Hundreds of people have come forward to say they were physically or sexually abused by priests or monks. As in the previous scandals in the U.S. and Ireland, the victims say their complaints were dismissed or ignored by the church hierarchy in Germany, which included Pope Benedict, who was Archbishop of Munich for part of that time. Reporter Thomas Marzal joins us from Berlin. Thomas, welcome.
Good morning, Linda.
When did these allegations begin to emerge?
They first surfaced in late January when Der Spiegel, which is Germany's most prominent weekly news magazine, put out allegations from victims that dated back to the 50s of sexual and physical abuse going on at a school here outside Berlin.
And what did the victims say happened to them?
The victim said that there had been sexual and physical abuse by priests at a boarding school there. And then gradually after that, the revelations started to spread across Germany and other victims came forward with allegations of abuse over a period of decades.
What, they say they brought these complaints to the attention of church authorities?
It's somewhat unclear when they brought these complaints to the attention of church authorities, but it is clear that from the anger that some of these victims are expressing, that they feel like the church has ignored their issues and has tried to put a wall of silence over the matter.
Now, Pope Benedict was a member of the church hierarchy in Germany for some of that time. Does any of this come close to including Pope Benedict?
The allegations have definitely come close to the Vatican because Pope Benedict was the Archbishop of Munich at the time back in the 1980s when a priest who had allegedly committed child sexual abuse was reassigned to this diocese in Munich and was ordered to undergo therapy and then was immediately allowed to resume pastoral duties. The then Archbishop, Cardinal Ratzinger, who is now Pope Benedict, then left Munich, and the priest was subsequently in 1986 convicted of sexual abuse and actually ordered jailed and ordered to pay a fine. That priest is still working to this day in a community in Upper Bavaria, and in fact, he was supposed to celebrate Mass yesterday in Bavaria and was substituted on short notice because these revelations of what he had done came out in a German newspaper on Friday.
Thomas, isn't there also a connection to the Pope's brother?
There is, because the Pope's brother was the head of the Regensburger Domspatzen, a renowned boys' choir in southern Germany for many years. A lot of abuse allegations have emerged just over the course of the last week or 10 days. He himself says that he was not aware of what occurred there. However, over the weekend, again, allegations emerged that some of these abuses may have occurred well into the 90s, and thus a lot of people are saying it's hard to believe that he would have not at least known of what was going on within the boys' choir.
What about the Vatican? What about the German church? What are they doing?
The top German Catholic bishop was in Rome on Friday for a meeting with the Pope. And the Pope said that he had been deeply moved by hearing about these allegations. But Pope Benedict has not publicly spoken out about the matter. Notably, yesterday during Mass in Vatican City, he did not even mention the word abuse. And quite a few Catholic officials, politicians, and Catholic laypeople are increasingly becoming angry with the Church for at least not addressing the matter. What's going on behind the scenes is, of course, another matter.
Thomas Marzal reporting from Berlin. Thomas, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're reporting this morning on another crisis for the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church hierarchy in Ireland has been heavily criticized for its handling of child abuse by priests. Now the scandal has reached the head of the church there.
In 1975, Cardinal Sean Brady heard testimony from two children who said they'd been abused in Ireland. The victims were asked to take a vow of silence. Cardinal Brady said he had no duty to tell the police. And he says he will only resign if the Pope orders him to.
Two public inquiries on child abuse in Ireland last year were especially critical of church leaders who tried to cover up the incidents. NPR's Rob Gifford reports that the scandal is driving more people away from the church in Ireland.
Siobhan O'Rourke can remember very clearly the brutality of her time at a Catholic school in Dublin in the 1970s. She hated it so much, she left the church altogether and left the country. O'Rourke returned a few years ago, but is now taking a stand and sending her children to one of Ireland's growing number of secular schools.
My children are not baptised, they're not confirmed, they haven't made their confirmation. I wouldn't want my children to have any association with an organisation that has failed to protect children in the past.
O'Rourke, who trained as a nurse, represents a growing number of people in Ireland who want to have nothing to do with the Catholic Church. She was among the first to leave, but since last year, a 30-year-old graduate student from the southern city of Cork has been making official departure from the church a whole lot easier.
I'll just take you to the website now. It's, okay, here it is now, yep.
Paul Dunbar was, like almost everyone in his generation, baptised as a Catholic at birth. But by his 20s, he says he was an atheist. The child abuse scandals led him to feel that he could no longer stay even nominally within the church. Since he'd been baptised, he was still a Catholic statistic, if not a Catholic believer. So he found out how officially to leave the church, a process known as defection. It was complex, so he created a website for anyone else who was interested in leaving.
So, like, for example, when you're filling out the census form, a lot of people will fill out Catholic as if it's an ethnic group rather than a religious belief. So in Ireland, it's almost like a blood type. People just unconsciously tick the box for Catholic. So I suppose we're trying to change that.
The downloads on his website, countmeout.ie, have totaled more than 7,000 since it was set up last year. Dunbar says that's a start, but he adds it's really nothing compared to the 90% of Ireland's 4.5 million people who are still registered as Catholics.
And I think there is still a fear that if you leave the church, you're somehow irreligious or you're irresponsible or you don't have any spirituality. So a lot of the people, even though they are very, very critical of the church, they still don't want to make that final step and make it official.
The Ray Darcy Show.
Irish radio and television have been filled with discussions about the child abuse scandals.
I had my first communion performed by a priest who has since been convicted of sex abuse. All photos from that day had that priest in them and have since been burnt.
One of the reasons the anger at the church has not translated into more defections is the close historical union of church and state in Ireland. In education, for instance, 92% of Irish public elementary schools are run by the Catholic Church. So in many areas, there's no alternative, and baptised Catholic children receive preference. That poses a problem for 33-year-old accountant Owen Smith and his wife, both atheists, both wanting officially to leave the church.
My wife very wisely argued that it's best to wait to do that until we see what school our son goes into. And with a busy or full Catholic school, they do have the right to refuse children who are not of their faith. So let's keep the pretense up for a little bit longer that we can slink our way into that faith if we need to get him into the school we want to get him into.
What's more, when Smith's son Oisín was born 2 years ago, he and his wife didn't even get him baptised.
Oh, I've heard stories of people going through getting children baptised at 4, just because it's now come up against it. They have no option but to get them into this one particular school and they're in the door straight away.
Would you do that?
Yeah. I don't think I'm got my moral principles are so strong that I'm not Irish to some sense, but I can't be slightly hypocritical about it and just do whatever it takes to get the best result I want.
During Lent, Mass is said in Latin in churches around Ireland, but numbers have decreased sharply. Breda O'Brien is a teacher at a large Catholic school in Dublin and also a columnist at the Irish Times newspaper.
It is a difficult time to be a committed practicing Roman Catholic in Ireland because there has been scandal after scandal. We feel, in a sense, I suppose, tarred with the same brush. A colleague actually called me an apologist for child abuse because I was trying to present some positive aspects of the Catholic Church.
O'Brien admits change is needed, but she rejects accusations that she's indoctrinating schoolchildren and pleads for Ireland not to throw the spiritual baby out with the clerical bathwater.
The days when children would accept something because it comes from the mouth of a religion teacher are long gone. The only successful indoctrinators in the world today are the marketers, the ones that make young people insecure about how they look and what they weigh and what they wear and the brands that they buy.
O'Brien worries that the gradual erosion of church influence will leave her students without a strong set of values to prevent them being swept away by the new consumerism. And if that sounds like scaremongering to some, ironically, the staunch atheist nurse Siobhan O'Rourke, who left Ireland more than 20 years ago, agrees.
As a country, we haven't really grown up fully, morally or spiritually. We've replaced a subservience and a belief in a higher power, a blind faith in a higher power that we didn't question, with subservience to consumerism and greed. It's impossible to tell how the next few years will be. I think we're in a state of disintegration.
Putting the pieces back together again is not proving easy. The Catholic Church still has influence in Ireland, but it has lost much of its role in gluing together Irish society. And no one's quite sure yet what, if anything, will take its place. Rob Gifford, NPR News.
We have a follow-up on a story from yesterday about the child abuse scandal affecting the Catholic Church in Germany. The church has suspended a German priest, saying he had violated an agreement not to have contact with minors.
Decades ago, Father Peter Hullermann was removed from his parish after allegations he had molested children. Then he was allowed to resume his duties after receiving therapy. At the time, the current pope was an archbishop in Germany.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. The Vatican is responding strongly to accusations that Pope Benedict tried to cover up the sexual abuse of children by priests. The Holy See's official prosecutor called those accusations false and calumnious. The charges stem from a number of abuse cases in Germany when the Pope was the Munich Archbishop Joseph Ratzinger. For more on this story, we're joined by longtime Vatican watcher John Allen. He's senior correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter and the author of two books on Pope Benedict. John Allen, welcome to the program.
Hi, Melissa.
The priest at the center of the sex abuse scandal in Germany has now been named Peter Hullermann. He was suspended yesterday, but the accusations against him go back decades. And why don't you tick through what Pope Benedict's connection is or was to this case?
Well, it's a tangled story, but here's the essence of it. Father Hullermann was a priest of another German diocese called Essen. In the late 70s, there were accusations that he had sexually abused some young men in that diocese. As was the practice of the church at the time, he was sent away for therapy, in this case into the Archdiocese of Munich, which at the time was led by then Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, now Pope Benedict XVI. And his arrival in Munich apparently happened with Cardinal Ratzinger's knowledge. But what then happened is that the priest was put back into the field in Munich, where he went on to commit other acts of abuse for which he was criminally convicted, actually, in 1986. Now, church officials in Munich have said that that decision to put him back into the field was made without Cardinal Ratzinger's knowledge. That is, the man who is now pope didn't know anything about it. In any event, the bottom line is that whatever Cardinal Ratzinger knew at the time, this decision to restore the priest to active ministry was made on his watch. That's obviously why this is so embarrassing and potentially damaging for the pope and for the Vatican.
Now, since he's been pope, going on 5 years now, what has Benedict said about child sex abuse within the church?
Well, I think this is one of the ironies of this story, because prior to these revelations from Germany, I think a lot of people actually would give Benedict XVI a fair amount of credit for his handling of the crisis. Immediately after taking over, there were a couple of very prominent priests in Rome who had had accusations made against them, but who had long been regarded as almost untouchable, who were very publicly disciplined. After that, the Pope became the first Pope ever to meet with sex abuse victims. He has become the first Pope ever to apologize directly and in his own name for the sex abuse crisis. So while all of that is to his credit, what critics would say is that the sex abuse crisis has always been in some ways two separate problems, the problem of priests who abused and the problem of bishops who failed to clean it up. And that is precisely what makes these revelations in Germany so potentially damaging, because the question that might arise would be, can Benedict XVI credibly address the problem of bishops who failed to clean this mess up if it turns out that his own track record as a diocesan bishop 30 years ago had the same problem?
John, what are you hearing about how concerned the Vatican is about the potential damage of these cases on Pope Benedict?
Well, I think it's very clear the Vatican is extraordinarily concerned. One bit of proof of that would be that normally when a scandal erupts someplace in the world, the Vatican measures its words very carefully and is often slow to react. But in this case, the Vatican had a statement out hours after that story broke, indicating that the Pope had not been aware of the reassignment of this predator priest. I think what all of that reflects is an awareness that if a pattern begins to emerge, that there was a kind of failure to intervene, then that could be extraordinarily damaging to the Pope's moral credibility in attempting to lead the Church out of this crisis.
And what might happen?
I don't think, Melissa, that it's likely to come to the stage of any serious talk about the Pope resigning. But I think there would be serious conversation about what other measures the Church needs to take and perhaps other leaders that need to step forward to fill the gap that the Pope might not be able to fill himself.
John Allen of the National Catholic Reporter. He's also author of the book The Rise of Benedict XVI. Thanks very much.
You're welcome, Melissa.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. If you place the Bible and the Quran side by side and compare them, which is the bloodier scripture? That's the question we put to NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty.
As the hijackers boarded the airplanes on September 11, 2001, they had a lot on their minds. And if they were following instructions, one of those things was the Quran. In preparation for the suicide attack, their handlers had told them to meditate on two chapters of the Quran in which God tells Muslims to cast terror into the hearts of unbelievers.
Slay the idolaters wherever you find them, arrest them, besiege them, and lie in ambush everywhere for them.
The chapter, as read in this audiobook, continues.
Prophet, make war on the unbelievers and the hypocrites and deal righteously with them. Hell shall be their home and evil fate.
When Osama bin Laden declared war on the West in 1996, he cited the Quran's command to strike off the heads of unbelievers. More recently, U.S. Army Major Nidal Hassan lectured his colleagues about jihad and the Quran's exhortation to fight unbelievers and bring them low. Hassan killed 13 people at Fort Hood, Texas, last year. Given this violent legacy, Philip Jenkins decided to compare the brutality quotient of the Quran and the Bible.
Much to my surprise, the Islamic scriptures and the Quran were actually far less bloody and less violent than those in the Bible.
Jenkins is a religion historian at Penn State University and author of the forthcoming book Dark Passages, which is already drawing controversy before it's even published. Violence in the Quran, he and others say, is largely a defense against attack.
Then we turn to the Bible and we actually find something as a for many people a real surprise. There is a specific kind of warfare laid down in the Bible which we can only call genocide.
It is called haram, and it means total annihilation. Consider the book of 1 Samuel, when God instructs King Saul to attack the Amalekites.
And utterly destroy all that they have, and do not spare them, but kill both man and woman, infant and nursing child, ox and sheep, camel and donkey.
When Saul failed to do that, God took away his kingdom.
In other words, Saul has committed a dreadful sin by failing to complete genocide. And that passage echoes through Christian history. It is often used, for example, in American stories of the confrontation with Indians. Not just is it legitimate to kill Indians, but you are violating God's law if you do not.
Jenkins notes that the history of Christianity is strewn with haram. During the Crusades in the Middle Ages, the popes declared the Muslims Amalekites. In the great religious wars, Protestants and Catholics each believed the other side were the Amalekites and should be utterly destroyed. But Jenkins says even though the Bible is violent, on the whole, Christianity and Judaism today are not.
What happens is in all religions, as they grow and mature and expand, they go through a process of forgetting of the original violence. And I call this a process of holy amnesia.
They make the violence symbolic. Wiping out the enemy becomes wiping out one's own sins. Jenkins says until very recently, Islam had the same sort of holy amnesia. Many Muslims interpreted jihad, for example, as an internal struggle, not physical warfare.
This is just preposterous. I'm sorry.
Andrew Bostom is editor of the book The Legacy of Jihad. He says there's a big difference between the Bible, which describes the destruction of an enemy at a point in time, and the Quran, which urges an ongoing struggle to defeat unbelievers.
It's an aggressive doctrine. The idea is to impose Islamic law on the globe.
Take suicide attacks, he says, a tactic that Muslims have used to great effect in the U.S., Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Middle East. It's true, suicide from depression is forbidden in Islam, but Bostom says the Quran and the Hadith, or sayings of Muhammad, do allow self-destruction for religious reasons.
The notion of jihad martyrdom is extolled in the Quran, Quran verse 9:111, and then in the Hadith, it's even more explicit. This is the highest form of jihad, to kill and to be killed in acts of jihad.
That may be the popular notion of jihad, says Waleed El Ansari, but it is the wrong one. El Ansari, who teaches Islamic studies at the University of South Carolina, says the Quran explicitly condemns religious aggression and the killing of civilians by making the distinction between jihad, legal warfare with the proper rules of engagement, and irjif, or terrorism.
All of those types of incidents, 9/11, Major Nida al-Hassan, and so forth, those are all examples of irjif, not jihad.
Which is wrong, according to
yeah.
Scripture.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. It takes one to hell.
So, what's going on here? After all, we all have images of Muslim radicals flying planes into buildings, shooting up soldiers at Fort Hood, and trying to detonate a bomb on an airplane on Christmas Day. How do you reconcile a peaceful Quran with these violent acts? Waleed El Ansari says in the past 30 years there's been a sort of perfect storm that has allowed for a violent strain of Islam. The first factor is political, that is, frustration at Western intervention in the Muslim world. The second is intellectual, the rise of Wahhabi Islam, a more fundamentalist interpretation of Islam subscribed to by the likes of Osama bin Laden. And so, El Ansari says, fundamentalists have distorted Islam for political purposes.
Basically, what they do is they take verses out of context and then use that to justify these egregious actions.
El Ansari says we are seeing more religious violence from Muslims today because the Islamic world is far more religious than is the West. Still, Philip Jenkins says Judeo-Christian culture should not be smug. The Bible has plenty of violence.
The scriptures are still there. They are dormant but not dead.
And can be resurrected at any time. For example, by white supremacists who cite the murderous Phineas when calling for racial purity, or by a conservative Christian when shooting a doctor who performs abortions. In the end, the scholars can agree on one thing. The DNA of early Judaism, Christianity, and Islam code for a lot of violence. Whether they can evolve out of it is another thing altogether. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.